Welcome to the official Saster podcast, where you can hear some of the best Saster speakers. This is where the cloud meets. Shortcut.com puts the can in Kanban, the agile in agile, the flow in your workflows. If you were at Saster Annual, you probably saw their booth. If you weren't, you didn't see their booth due to limitations with how physical reality works. Either way, you should check out shortcut.com/Saster and get 2 months free. Litmus helps you create and test effective email fast. Customer experience is everything. If your email marketing doesn't look good, your brand doesn't look good. Get on-brand, error-free emails with Litmus every single time. Try for free at litmus.com/SAASTR. As you scale your company, don't let data onboarding hold you back. Importing customer data has traditionally been a time-consuming, painful process. Now, with Flatfile's data onboarding platform, your customers can import data into your SaaS solution with one simple click. Learn more at flatfile.com/Saster to find out how. Up today, episode 500 of the Saster podcast. Saster original podcaster Harry Stebbings of 20VC and Saster CEO and founder Jason Lemkin discuss the future of the markets and how to build a successful SaaS sales team from the ground up.
Jason, this is such a joy to do, my friend. It's been such a long time. I'm so excited to have you here, but thank you so much for joining me.
Harry, thanks for getting us back together. I'm very excited.
Listen, it'll be a great one, but I do want to start with a little bit on you. I'd love to set some context. So a lot of people know the Saster brand, but how did you make your entry into the world of venture and come to found Saster? Let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago now, but literally 10 years ago of my cohort of SaaS founders, the Aaron Levy's, the David Sachs's, the others, I was the first one to have a half decent exit. And so when SaaS was harder, when cloud was much harder, today when there were one unicorn called Salesforce, I was the first one that didn't have to pretend, that didn't have to always claim every day was great. And I just started blogging my mistakes. And that blog took off. And then one of the VCs that had invested in me, Storm Ventures, brought me in as a partner. I'd never done any investments before. But I just invested in some of the founders that were fans of the Saster blog, and it worked out okay. Like, you know, the first four investments eventually became unicorns, five out of the first six. And so it kind of took off organically, but I certainly didn't intend to invest out of that or build a huge community. It was just to share my learnings and mistakes when I had nothing to hide.
Can I ask, when you look at those five out of the first six, I mean, I know the companies there. It is an incredible cohort of companies. When you look back at that, are there some lessons that you have from those early investments that you take with you today and impact how you think about investing today?
I would say two things. One, certainly, especially in the last 20 months, the world has changed, right? They're just so... The funny thing was back, even 5 or 6 years ago in SaaS and cloud, like you could meet with every good SaaS founder. I remember waking up when I read that Mamoon had invested in Slack back in the day. I'm like, I didn't see that deal. Now, like all the 90% of the unicorns, I never heard of them, right? The universe is so big. So that's changed. The sheer scale of the cloud obviously is 100x what it was 5 years ago, 1,000x what it was 10 years ago, which is difficult to wrap your brain around. So that's changed, right? You were saying before we went on some great deals you missed. You should miss tons of deals today because there's too many good ones, right? I'll tell you what hasn't changed when I look back over the years is you've got to be crazy to be a founder and build a decacorn. You have to be crazy. It's so hard, right? It is easier today. Let's be clear. It is easier to build a SaaS company today. The tools are there. The systems are there. The markets are larger, right? They're more understood. But the best ones, the decacorns and the unicorns, these founders were insanely committed to building something huge in a way that almost doesn't make rational sense, right? And Harry, you have a little bit of that with the 20 Empire. I see it. That's why I've always known it would be wildly successful. But when you don't see that, my rule is, and I've made this mistake since, don't invest. No matter how much you love the founder, you can love them as humans. They can be doing very well. But if you don't have this crazy 20-year commitment to building something huge, it's hard to make money in venture.
You know, the one thing that I continuously hear from VCs is the markets are 1,000x as big or 100x as big as you mentioned. Yeah. And so ownership doesn't matter as much anymore.
Yes.
How do you think about that?
I think it's a great argument on a spreadsheet, right? Certainly owning 2% of a Datadog, 1%. And we look back, we look at all the individual investors in Uber that became decamillionaires out of, and you're like, wow, I could have done that. I don't know. I'm not smart enough. But when I look over my, you know, 8-year history of investing, it's the ones with the double-digit ownership that move the needle. And for better or worse, when I've had my own fund, when I look at what the companies I'm sitting on today, obviously you regret ones you missed or you didn't. But all of my core positions are double-digit ownership, largest investor in most of them. And that one puts you in a good position if you get a unicorn, right? Owning 20% of a unicorn still works today. If you give up a decacorn, it was a miss. So I guess it all boils down to, I think there was one rule when I started investing that the folks I worked with thought was disagreed with vehemently, but it certainly turned out to be true. When you meet a winner, you buy all the shares. Now, if you can buy a quarter of the company, you buy a quarter of the company. If you can buy 2% of the company, you buy 2% of the company. But you either buy all of them or none. And I think that's the way you solve through this, right? And if all you could buy was 2% of a decacorn and you get $200 million, that's pretty good. But buying less doesn't help.
Would you agree that venture is less collaborative now than ever before? Someone said that to me on the show the other day.
Without question. And without question, it's better for founders. Every element of venture that is, and I'm being binary when it's, of course, more subtle than this, but much of the collaboration in venture did not benefit founders, right? The fact today that the craziest thing to me in venture isn't anything you're saying. The craziest thing to me in venture is there are over 100 founder and operator-led funds of over 50 million. That means if you are connected, okay, and this is for the privileged, okay, which we could talk about. But if you're connected, you might not never need a VC until Series B. If you can raise 10 million from founder-led fund, operator funds, rolling funds, and that works for you, like you can get it done in a week or two, like why would you deal with a bunch of collaborative VCs that all want to own 15 or 20% of your company when value is not consistent with ownership? Right? That's the underlying tension that we've been talking about for years, but we're realizing is we get value out of our cap table. We don't get value consistent with ownership.
I totally right? agree.
For me, it's hard. I'm sure it's hard for you, Harry. I get so many inbounds and they're like, Jason, would you join our round? We have 100 or 200K left and I can't do it, right? Because they're asking me to recruit their VP of sales, build their team for less than 1% of the company. And if I was angel investing, I might do it. And if I had time on my hands, right? But I can't do it. I don't know. You get so overloaded. But that's a smart thing for a founder to do. That's a smart. And if the founders can get a great operator, a great CMO, CRO, ex-founders with time on their hands to all do this, I mean, it's amazing. And I invested in a lot of French startups, Algolia's and France and Gorgeous and Plato. And it's interesting. Olivia from Datadog would invest in all of them back in the day. They all knew him. He was a hub, right? And Datadog went public. He got a little busy. But back in the day, he was so helpful on every cap table. Why wouldn't you want him for 1% versus some fund that complains that the board meetings are inconvenient for his schedule? Why wouldn't you want Olivia in your cap table? Of course you would, right?
No, I'm totally with you. One final question before we dive into the meat. And it's like, bluntly, when we look at funding environments today, I call it the foie grasing of startups, which is like, especially in SaaS, this worries me. Because you give a founder 60 million when they're 25K MRR or 50K yes. MRR, and suddenly they hire 20 sales reps, 10 in marketing, and they don't have a playbook and they don't have repeatability. Do you see this too? Are you as concerned by it as I am?
I'm not concerned by it.
Huh.
I believe that with help, and this is why you need good advisors, you need good capital, you need the best founders eventually hire great VPs. Okay, sometimes they screw up a few VP hires. Oftentimes they'll fall in love with the logo. They'll want someone from Datadog or Dropbox, whoever. Everyone makes that mistake. Maybe your advisors help you avoid it. But the great VPs, the truly great ones, not the good ones, the great VPs know how to spend the money. Okay, the mediocre ones fall into a hole. What happens is you hire a mediocre VP of sales, and let's say, oh my God, the CEO promised we're going to go from 1 million to 10 million this year. That's what I promised. When I raised the money, I didn't promise 1 to 2 or 1 to 3. Even 1 to 3 was the old days was a lot. I'm promising 1 to 10, right? And we're seeing at least 1 to 5, 1 to 6 all the time these days, right? So I did the promise. What does a mediocre VP of sales do if there's 60 million in the bank? They spend it all. They spend it. The mediocre ones, 100% of them spend it all. The marketers spend everything. We see it, Harry, you and I have seen it multiple times. A mediocre CMO will come in, or just a misfit, a mismatch. More often it's a mismatch CMO, and they'll spend everything on advertising and media. But the great ones, you know what? They spend maybe 50% more. The great ones don't hire crummy reps, the great sales leaders, right? They build amazing teams. They just might hire a bigger sales enablement team, a bigger RevOps team to support them, right, than you otherwise would. The great marketers don't spend money on programs that don't perform. So I think this is true, but I blame the CEOs for lowering the bar on hiring for VPs. I don't see them blowing through all the money. I never see it. I haven't seen it.
I think you're right, definitely, in terms of the best always hire, you know, the best VPs. So I get you there. I do want to dive into the meat of the show, though, because, you know, I think, you know, obviously one area where we're both very passionate is sales, and it's where I get the most questions, I think, from founders in particular. Start on the meta, which is like, fundamentally, does the founder need to be the person who creates the first sales playbook, or can that be distributed to a sales rep or a head of sales?
Well, look, I think I would say the majority of B2B companies that are successful that you and I have worked with, Harry, the majority, but not all, the founder has been the first head of sales. My first Decacorn, Saster Podcast 001, you did with Tiago from Talkdesk, right? He was the only salesperson through the first 2 million of revenue. That's where I learned. On the other hand, sometimes it's just not you, right? Sometimes you cannot be a great sales rep. And when I look at my second investment back in the day, another unicorn, Algolia, Nicholas, who you've interviewed, was okay at this, but he brought in Gaten, like his chief business officer, really as almost a late co-founder. He was probably employee number one or two because these engineers just weren't great at sales. And it became clearly that the search API had a sales element, right? So if you don't have that DNA, find that great, almost co-founder like salesperson early and it can work, right? But hiring that person over Craigslist or over LinkedIn or whatever, that's the one that fails, right? So we all believe in this early founder-led sales, and it's true most of the time, but it's not true all the time. But you sure better found a co-founder like person to pick up the slack.
Okay, if you think about kind of the first sales hires, often founders do say they've built the playbook and they're at a millionaire or say whatever, some number. They go, should I hire a head of sales who brings in the team around them and crafts that team? Or should I bring in two sales reps and build it from the ground up? How do you advise founders in that situation?
Well, again, we've learned over time there's the scenario that works 80% of the time, but you don't have to run that playbook. What works 80% of the time is 80% of the great cloud SaaS CEOs we've worked with, they hire two quirky sales reps and get them doing pretty well, hitting quota or beyond. Often one of them just crazy good, right? And we can talk about what that persona looks like. And when you've hired two, you're generally ready to hire a VP to hire 300. You have just enough of an engine, just enough of a playbook, just as importantly, a playbook that works, that you can start reproducing that playbook from 300 to 300. If you don't have those two AEs and you hire a VP of sales, 80% of the time it doesn't work because there's nothing for them to work with, right? And the good ones, and importantly today, a good VP of sales usually won't join a startup at that phase. That's one thing that's changed the last 5 years we could chat about, is the great VP of sales are waiting for 10 million. The ones that used to join at 1 million, they're all waiting for a 10 million ARR startup today or a unicorn, whichever comes earlier, all of them. But if you possibly can get two performing reps yourself, it's going to make that whole process 10 times easier.
I want to talk about those two reps. You mentioned that. What do we want in those two reps? What do they look like? What are the character types? What makes you go, this is a 10x rep and we want you in our team?
Well, let's be clear. The 10x reps in the early days are not the 10x reps later. Okay. Hopefully they stay forever. The best ones stay. If you're lucky, keep them. But they're different. But I will tell you how to hire them and what they look like, because they're two different things. The 10x sales rep in the early days has 1.5 criteria. It's really this simple. Okay. First, make sure they've sold at your price point, at your ACV. If you're a 5K ACV startup, do not hire someone from $1 million a year group, no matter how much you love them. It's the wrong toolkit, right? The toolkit is roughly the same for every startup at a given ACV, at a given price point. So make sure they've sold in cloud, in SaaS at your price point. Otherwise, don't fall in love with them. Two, and most folks screw that up. The second one, all the founders screw this up. Harry, would you buy from her? They listen to the buzzwords and they listen to the talk and they do the reference check. But if you've sold the first 100 copies of your product, if you've sold the first 200 sponsorships at 20, you know whether you can trust these precious leads to somebody else. And whenever I talk with the founder and I'm asked, how did it go? Well, my first two reps didn't work out. I'm like, what happened? And I always ask them one question. What would you have bought from them? Would you buy your own? The answer is always no. So you can give on a lot. You can give on the fact that they were never great, that they were always mid-pack. You can give on the fact that they sold at a six-tier competitor. You can give on the fact that they never got to 20 million in their whole lives. You can give on a lot of things. ACV is tough to give on, and the fact that you would buy from never works. And then, so that's the criteria, okay? And if they just pass those two criteria, they will work, okay? They will work for you. They can stay for a decade. Now I'll tell you what makes them 10X. What makes them 10X, and it took me a long time to figure this out, is that they can change their playbook. 90% of sales reps, and this works out the bigger you get, they sell exactly the same way. Harry, hi, this is Jason from 2020 Media. We have a podcast sponsorship. We start at $100,000 a month. Where can I send the PO, right? Now, when 20 gets really big, that actually will work 8 times out of 10. But think about the early days. It wouldn't work. And 90% of sales reps, no matter how, they just run the same playbook again and again and again. And the bigger your brand gets, the more that works. But the great ones, especially in the early days, they change the playbook based on who the prospect is. And that may sound obvious because as founders, we do this intuitively, but it's not how many great reps are trained. They're trained in a process and a system. They get really good at the 10 questions in the script. So those early reps can be great just if they're at your ACV and you would trust your lead. That's enough. Hire her. But if they actually can sell 3 or 4 different use cases, they understand the different buying personas already, that's when the magic just happens and you get the 10Xer. And that's the criteria of every top rep at any SaaS company I've talked to, is they can completely change the sales playbook based on the prospect, based on the buyer.
Can I ask one thing I find very, very challenging? It's like quota creation. And it's like, how do you advise on the right quota that is both ambitious and it's hard to get, but also it's not too ambitious where it's just too far out of reach? What's the right balance?
The good news is the middle's hard, but the beginning of this process and the end are easy, okay? When you're really early stage, your quota should be enough that the sales rep won't quit, that they can eat. So you need to make sure that at least the first 3 to 6 months, if you're sub 1 million to 2 million in ARR, that they get a boost, okay? And often it's simplest to almost give them, I know it can sound crazy, sometimes it's almost easy to give them 100% of what they close. If it's hard, right? You close 10K this month, you take home 10K. Like, it's really simple, right? Obviously that's not profitable, but it's almost 100%. Like, they take home 100%. That can be okay for the first 3 months. You have to train people. You have to onboard them. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't work at scale, right? But you need to back into it. Okay, I've hired this new rep, Harry. He's got to make 100K a year. Let me be honest with myself. If he can close 200K, it's so early. That's a gift, right? So I'm going to pay Harry half of what he closes. That turns out to be, you have to be analytical. They have to eat. And then at scale, we end up at these 3X, 4X, 5X numbers, right? Which is, quotas are in SMB usually 3X your fully burdened comp, your on-target earnings, your OT, up to 5X in the enterprise. So that's the way it works, 3X, 4X, 5X. It's actually worked since in the early, like, it's always been 3 to 5X of profits, going back to automobile sales, anything you could sell, right? Pool supplies. It's just because software approaches 100% gross margin, sales reps could keep 3 to 5X. This 3 to 5X worked for revenue, right? Not the profit. But that's the way it works. So at scale, if you want to make $200,000 a year as a sales rep, great. In SMB, you got to bring in 600, mid-market 800, enterprise 1 million. And then the question is in the middle, especially if you have capital or if you don't, where do you want to bend those rules until you're at scale, right? But ultimately, at some point, as you approach IPO or something, your metrics have to be normal, don't they?
Absolutely, they do. Right. My question is also, like, when you look at enterprise, given the conversion length in terms of the sales cycles,
yes,
it's very difficult to know if your reps are actually good. How do you think
it's very stressful?
What are signs then when you have a founder that goes, Jason, they haven't closed anything, but they've only been here 4 months. How do you know if they're good?
Yeah, there's a startup I invested in. It's taken a while. They were founded in 2017. And the beginning of this quarter, they were at 2 million, okay, since 2017. This quarter, they finally closed 1 million. So 2 to 3 million in one quarter. Not a single enterprise rep has ever worked out. You keep waiting and waiting and waiting. When you're at scale, you know, because long sales cycles don't matter at scale. North of 20, 30 million in revenue, you're lining up so many deals at the same time that long sales cycles don't matter, because if you have 100 deals in flight, it actually starts to happen very predictably, right? But you need like 100 long sales cycle deals, not Sony baloney pipeline, but actually in flight that are going to close before this gets de-stressed. And how many startup founders have 100 enterprise deals in flight? It takes a while, right? So there's really only two answers, and it's stressful. There's no great answer. One is, I've found that in true enterprise, like real enterprise, the founder is often the VP of sales until 10 million. I've seen this again and again and again. Now, I'm not saying they don't have a VP of sales, okay? But I think in SMB, you can be hands-off at a million or two in revenue, even if you did founder-led sales. I find that in enterprise, they're so good at speaking to the big customers. They're so trusted, right? Those Harry we know, like, we trust him. All the customers trust him. Google trusts him. Whoever trusts him. And so Harry is already in every deal until this brand is so established that Harry just gets pulled into the deal. So I actually think, to tell founders that are pulling their hair out in enterprise, keep pulling it out, because it's not going to get better. It's just going to get more repeatable, and you will be the head of sales until 10 million. And so what that means is, the big mistake that I see founders that are true enterprise make is they just have too much faith in these AEs. You have to see more progress. You have to judge it. And even if you have a 9-month sales cycle, you have to say 4 months in, are these deals really moving at the pace they did when I run them? Are they really working as well? Because otherwise, it's fake, right? It's fake energy, isn't it?
It totally is. The thing I worry about is like founder dependency. And I think about this with me now, dealing with sponsorship management. It's like, how do I extricate myself from the process? Because you don't want to be in every process where it's founder dependent.
Like, what would happen to SpaceX if Elon Musk was gone, or Tesla? Founder dependency is part of the game.
Yeah.
it's part of the game, right? I think it's one of these existential risks for investing too, right? What if something happens? I got an email over the weekend from a great, literally one of the best founders I've known my entire life, saying, his co-founder is kind of transitioning to an IC role, right? I'm like, God, that's high risk. That's higher risk than losing a customer or some sort of other existential issue, right? Because a founder dependency is an existential problem. And you got, making yourself obsolete is the dream of every founder, but maybe you could only come close. And it's true in sales. And when I started doing these SaaStr events, I would interview all the CEOs. In the early days, I would ask the Jeff Lawsons from Twilio and the Peter Gassner from Veeva, and I would say, how much time do you spend in sales? Like in the early days, before they were all bigger. And they're like, more than ever. More? I'm like, really, Jeff? You just went public at Twilio in 2017. You're a developer focused company. You're spending more time in sales than ever. Yes. Now, sometimes that means more time with customers. It's not always prospects, right? As you get bigger, you talk about 10-year customers. You want to move your time as CEO more to customers and prospects, but it never goes down. And that I think that's emblematic of this level of founder dependency.
Shortcut.com is project management without all the management. Imagine if your project management tool didn't make you want to throw your computer out a window and instead made you want to hug it. Visit shortcut.com/SaaStr and get 2 months free. Litmus helps you create and test effective email fast. Customer experience is everything. If your email marketing doesn't look good, your brand doesn't look good. Get on-brand, error-free emails with Litmus every single time. Try for free at litmus.com/SAASTR. Flatfile is the data onboarding platform that B2B SaaS companies rely on to drastically improve their customers' data import experience. With one-click import, your customers get their data in your solution instantly. The result? Faster time to value. Go to flatfile.com/SaaStr and find out how.